Afternoon, everyone, and thanks for joining today's Fuels America call. We've got three speakers with us today who are going to talk to you about a new ad campaign that Fuels America is launching this week, and I'm glad you could join us for this. So first, we're going to have Bob Dineen, President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. Tom Bias, Growth Energy CEO, is also on the line. And then Adam Monroe, President of Novozymes North America, will also be delivering remarks. So with that, I'm going to hand the call over to Bob to kick us off.
Thank you, Ann, and thank you to all of you who've joined us on the call today. Today, those of us who are members of Fuels America are pleased to announce the launch of a new multi-platform ad campaign. We're talking about the fundamental choice America's facing when it comes to our fuel mix. Do we want alternatives to oil or not? Some in Congress have forgotten about that choice. But the debate over the RFS should not occur in a vacuum. If we don't have the RFS, if we don't have biofuels, then what? Our opposition is trying to fool Americans into thinking oil is our only option, that we can frack our way to energy independence, that alternatives to oil drive up the price of gasoline and food and can't be counted upon in the future. Wrong. So that's why we're launching a new ad campaign tomorrow that will serve as a reminder that there is a choice. We can stick with the status quo, or we can develop innovative new energy sources. We can live with oil spills and environmental disaster, or enjoy safer, cleaner fuels. We can hand our money over to the oil monopoly, or reap the benefits of fuel diversity. Hopefully these ads will have just hit your inboxes as the call started. They'll be running in print, online, on radio and TV, showing two visions of our future. One with oil's monopoly, and one with renewable fuel. Now our opponents are running their own ads. They're predicated on the false assumption that E15 is mandated by EPA, that will damage engines, and that there is no means around the oil company constructed blend wall. Wrong on all counts. And almost as soon as they were released, we saw AAA groups taking API to task for misleading consumers about their RFS position. E15 is not mandated. There are ways to scale and ultimately dismantle the blend wall, including E85 and higher ethanol blends, and there is a real choice available to consumers today. Oil companies just have to provide market access. When they don't allow marketers to sell E85, they're denying choice. When they run to the courts to stop E15, they're trying to deny consumers a choice at the pump. And when they petition Congress to repeal the RFS, they're leaving no choice but their petroleum. We're about choice. We're about market access. And these ads will demonstrate the consequences of that choice to all Americans. Tom, you want to pick up?
Thanks, Bob. I'm Tom Bias with Growth Energy, and I think Bob hit on a lot of the very strong points on why the renewable fuel standard is so important, and what we're doing here today with the ads about there is a choice. And the choice is something that I think every American has always hoped for in our production of fuels and energy. If you go back since the early 70s, with the first OPEC oil embargo, which brought our country's economy virtually to its knees. We had gas lines. We've had economic shock after economic shock over the last 40-some years because of higher fuel prices. And just as you wouldn't put all your eggs in one basket in any business you do, we shouldn't do it as a nation in our fuel choice. And I think that's an important message, not just in the ads that we're running, but the message to Congress. As Bob indicated, oil has tried everything they can, from regulatory hurdles, legal hurdles, PR, and now this desperate attempt to get Congress to change the law because they're afraid of competition. We know that biofuels are cheaper. They're better for the environment. They create jobs. They give consumers choice at the pump, and that's really what it's all about. And in fact, even if you if they listen to their constituents, they'll find in a recent poll conducted by Fuels America all the support for renewable fuels. 80% of Americans think the nation should be using more renewable fuel. 75% of Americans want more renewable fuel options at their gas station. 78% believe we should be transitioning from an oil-based economy to an economy that uses more renewable fuels. 68% believe renewable fuels are more sustainable energy source than oil. And 69% agree that increasing the amount of renewable fuel we use is critical to our national security. Tomorrow, as you know, there's a beginning of 2 days of hearing in the House and Energy Subcommittee, Energy and Commerce Subcommittee on Energy and Power, regarding the renewable fuel standard and higher blends. A number of us will be testifying, and we certainly look forward to that opportunity to be able to tell the facts and not just this misinformation perpetuated by critics with vested interests. So with that, I'll stop and hand it over to Adam Monroe, North American president of Novozymes.
Thanks, Tom. Both Tom and Bob made some fantastic points, and I'm going to give you a little bit of the technology angle to this because it's an incredibly important American innovation story. I have to admit my background is chemical engineering, and I'm lucky enough to be surrounded by people every day that don't accept today's norms as the way it has to be in the future. Our company has over 6,000 patents in 40 different industries, from laundry to leather, and beer and biofuels, and we just don't look at the world as it has been, but what it could be. And that's why our company motto is Rethink Tomorrow. And I believe we were rethinking tomorrow as a nation when we passed the renewable fuel standard just 6 short years ago. We knew that a powerful cartel known as OPEC was the primary controller of the price of the only transportation fuel we had or have. And we also knew that just what any good business person would tell you, that there is nothing that will change a monopoly like disruptive technology and an alternative product. As a nation, we had the promise of abundant feedstocks and fantastic scientists, so we made this strategic decision as a country to break this monopoly. And so we started our journey. Companies went to their labs and invented new microorganisms that can make everything you can make from a barrel of oil. They started to work with completely new feedstocks like trash and wood waste and ag waste. And they started to work with brand new feedstocks like biomass, sorghum, and energy grasses that you could grow where there's very little water or very hot conditions. It's an incredible innovation story that has happened since 2007. And today, if you look around, there are a number of plants that are being built that are full-scale commercial plants. And I want to tell you about some of those. One, which is a partner of ours, is Fiberite, and they're in Virginia. And their business model is incredible. Instead of the trash truck that comes by your house and picks up your trash going to the landfill, it goes to their facility, and they turn it into biofuels and generate electricity that they sell back to the grid and create fertilizer that can be used in agriculture. Chemtex, another partner of ours, working on a huge project in North Carolina where they're going to grow energy grasses on fields that hog farmers use to remediate their waste from their hog farms, where this shows that livestock and biofuel producers can work together in new ways to do some incredibly important things for our country, including employing over 100 people in some of the poorer parts of our country. And then there's Keyore in Mississippi, where their technology uses wood waste and yellow pine, which there's a lot of in the South and Southeast, and they turn it into bio-crude and deliver it to the same refineries where they refine crude oil. But this case, it's renewable feedstocks grown here in the U.S., employing people in places like Mississippi and Alabama, those parts of the world. And then there's large multinationals like Abengoa, who are building a plant in Kansas. They're almost complete. INEOS in Florida, where they're taking they're also taking municipal solid waste, but also garden and food waste and all kinds of materials, and turning that into a gas and then feed it to a microorganism that turns it into ethanol. And the list goes on, including large companies like POET, DuPont, and Abengoa, as I mentioned. So how did we get here? And it's a lot about this challenge that the country laid down and not accepting the norm, but asking why. Some folks are going to tell you that these fuels will never exist. Why? DuPont, Abengoa, POET, INEOS, Keyor, Chemtex, they're all funding and building or built their own commercial plants. Why are these companies spending billions of dollars to make these fuels? Some will tell you that there's this blend wall for biofuels and it's bad for your engine. Well, why do they say that? The Brazilians drive on 18 to 25% ethanol every day in cars that are made by Ford, GM, Toyota. Why can they do it and we can't? Of course we can. And you may not know it, but during one of the worst economies of the last 100 years, the biofuels industry built 300 advanced manufacturing facilities in this country and employed thousands of people in rural America right when we needed them. And the wages that were paid to those people in those plants went into American hands and they were spent in the United States. That's $50 billion a year that stayed right here at home and didn't go into the hands of folks who don't always like us. Why did this happen? Because as a nation, we were brave enough to believe we could find alternatives and disruptive technologies to our decades-long monopoly situation. So we've developed the technologies, we're building the plants, so why are the opponents attacking us as we're crossing the finish line? Like most disruptive technologies and alternatives, they're very serious threats to an existing monopoly. Is that what they're really concerned about? So let me close by just saying, on behalf of all the people that work in these facilities and are going to work in these new plants, and those that are continuing to develop the technologies and not accept the status quo, I ask all of you not to be distracted by the incumbents' actions and continue to be brave, support the renewable fuel standard, and join us and keep rethinking tomorrow. I'll close there and turn it back over to Ann.
All right. Well, thanks, Adam, and thanks, Bob and Tom, for your remarks. Operator, we are ready to open the line to questions.
Our first question will come from Amy Harder, National Journal.
Hi. Thanks so much for holding this conference call. In light of the hearings in the Energy and Commerce Committee tomorrow, it seems like we're getting to the point in that committee where they're going to start drafting legislation that could be marked up later this year. What specific legislative approaches are you guys open to considering, or do you want Congress to keep its hands off the RFS entirely and would prefer, you know, to have any change, if there is any change to the RFS, to have it be done through EPA?
Amy, this is Bob Dineen. Look, we've been pretty clear throughout this process that there's nothing wrong with the RFS that can't be fixed with what is right with the RFS. That Congress did a great job in 05 and 07 in crafting the renewable fuel standard with more than enough flexibility, administrative flexibility, and flexibility for obligated parties to address some of the concerns that have been raised. And we don't see any need for legislation today. And we'll be telling Congress that tomorrow. And I'd further suggest that, you know, I'm not convinced that Congress is careening toward, you know, a legislative package out of the Energy and Commerce Committee. I think they're going to hear a lot tomorrow and the next day about this. They've learned a lot through the white paper process. And I think hopefully they are beginning to understand that the flexibility built into the program and you allow the program to continue to operate, the issues that have been raised about it, I think, will be addressed.
We'll move to Rachel Gantz with Oil Price Info Service.
Yes, hi. I wanted to find out details about the ad campaign in terms of the cost. the length of it, where the ads will run, and was this launched in response to API's ads?
Rachel, this is Bob again. Look, there's no point to us talking specifics about the campaign. Suffice it to say, this is a very serious effort. We know that we are under attack by an opponent that is highly funded with messaging that is illogical and misleading people about this program. And we want to, again, make sure that folks do understand there's a choice. Our campaign will be across multiple platforms, as we've indicated, and we anticipate it to be able to respond to the challenge at hand.
Is it running just in the D.C. area? Is it a national campaign?
This is a campaign that will be targeted to Washington, D.C., which is where the public policy debate will occur.
We'll move next to Amanda Paterka with Greenwire.
I wanted to check in on the final two, when you expect them to come out. Do you see them coming out soon now that Gina McCarthy is confirmed? And are you, through your conversations with EPA and through everything you've heard, are you expecting the agency to lower the overall advance number?
Amanda, again, this is Bob. I think EPA has indicated that they anticipate the rule coming out in final before the end of the summer. I would expect it this month. I have not heard from EPA, nor would they be allowed to tell anybody what they're ultimately going to do with the advanced number, but I am certain that EPA has taken all the comments into account and will act appropriately.
We'll move next to Spencer Chase with AgriPulse.
Yes, thank you for taking my question. I guess what I'm wondering relates to the fact that this is not exactly a new debate. The RFS has been attacked several times, so I'm wondering what has changed in your defense of the RFS for this go-around?
Dom, you want to take that one?
Sure. I mean, what has changed? I mean, what has changed from the attacks on the RFS? I'd turn that back around. We're seeing the same old rhetoric that we've seen forever, and I think what's different about this debate this time is oil knows that, you know, if they don't aren't able to change the RFS on the legislative process because they've lost on the regulatory and the legal fronts on raising the blend wall, that they'll use this as an excuse to basically undermine the RFS. And any weakening, any backing off on it is definitely a threat to the future of it because, one, that's what they want. They don't want to see the higher blends. They don't want to see the next generation feedstocks developed, as Adam so eloquently discussed. We have to be able to understand this was a 15-year plan, the RFS. It was signed into law just a little over 5 years ago. The rulemaking wasn't finalized until 3 years ago. So in essence, we're 3 years into a 15-year plan. It's working. We've said that from day one. Give it the time to work, and it will. And I don't think we're going to waver in those views whatsoever, anyone in the biofuel space.
We'll move next to Amy Harder with National Journal.
Hi. Thanks for allowing me two questions. I actually have two questions here to ask you. You've focused a lot on the oil industry and its lobbying effort on this front. And, of course, API has been very active, but it's not the only lobbying group at play here. How do you feel with regards to the other groups, the restaurants and the poultry groups and some of the livestock groups? How do you feel threatened by those groups? And it just seems like, from my perspective at least, and the amount of press releases and whatnot that I get from both sides, it seems that there is a wide swath of interest opposed to the RFS. So do you feel like you're a bit outnumbered in this debate? How do you anticipate making sure your voice is heard when you have such a diverse lobbying against you? And then my second question is, and maybe this can be specifically for Adam, but how do you hope that the corn ethanol and the advanced biofuels industry can stay united in this type of debate?
Well, man, I'll tell you what, I've been doing this a long time. This is Bob Denny. And we've always had, you know, opponents to this, but there have always been proponents as well. And there are today. And there are consumer groups and environmental groups and ag groups that are all a part of Fuels America. And I think you have two strong coalitions going after one another. The folks in the, you know, big food that have joined Big Oil to oppose this have never been enthusiastic about ethanol, have always been more intent upon securing cheap feedstock and benefiting from government programs that have subsidized corn and kept their costs lower. But now that there's a value-added market that is having an impact, you know, they are crying foul, pun intended. But you know, it's really more of the same. The dialogue hasn't changed any. The volume has probably changed a bit because we are now a bigger, more significant part of the U.S. motor fuel market. And you know, fine, let's have the debate. But I think when all the facts are on the table, it is clear that the RFS is working. The RFS is providing a choice that is allowing the energy market to diversify. You know, this is the debate we're in.
Yeah, and this is, Adam, if I take your second question, there's a number of answers as to why I think both the corn-based ethanol and the advanced biofuels companies, some of which are in both efforts as we are, have a lot of things in common, including technology. An example of that, obviously, is POET, where they are the largest, depending on the day, ethanol producer in the country, primarily through corn, but they're also working with the ag waste that comes from the corn field to make advanced biofuels, and the synergy that goes on in one common plant using common utilities and all these kind of things. There's some very, really, really neat innovation that's going on there. So I think there's a lot more joining forces than there was at one time when everybody was innovating and looking at different molecules and what have you. The other thing that I think is beginning to dawn on folks is that, look, When we laid out the policy in 2007 and subsequently built 300 plants around the country, and then suddenly when we're at 10% because we've run up on the oxygenate amount that the oil industry needs, but now we need to blend higher fuels for simply the purpose of providing alternative fuels in the country, we're getting a lot of resistance. If we're willing to knock back 300 plants and all those jobs, then what disinformation is going to come along that's going to knock us back on advanced biofuels in the future? So I think both the recognition that the opposition isn't in this just because you know, because they need oxygenate, but that this might steal more of the barrel is a big threat. So I think there's more folks joined in this than there are diverse. So I think technology and also the recognition that they're not going to let us into this thing just for free.
And Adam, do you also support any that Congress shouldn't touch the RFS at all, that any changes, if necessary, should go through EPA?
I do support that, but let me tell you why. Look, I don't work in Washington, and I can recognize that almost any policy that's ever put forward, when you look back in time, there may be something here or there that somebody would love to tweak, and it's always different depending on who you are. But what concerns me more than anything as an investor and somebody who's put a lot of money into this is that if a change were made, even in pursuit of perfection, I'm going to wait for how long for rules to be administered. I'm going to wait to see what new attacks are going to come along with the new version. And I think what's going to happen in reality is a lot of people are not only going to sit on the sidelines, they're going to go home, and they're going to put their money somewhere else in the world where they can do something better with it. So I'm more a proponent of pursuing the good in absence of the perfect at this point in time. I think there's been plenty of success that we've seen. I think I laid out a lot of the innovation that has occurred and is ongoing. And if it has done all that, I'll accept whatever imperfection somebody out there might be able to find in this policy, and I'm sure there are some. But for now, what I need is stability. I don't need perfection.
And we'll move next to Cindy Zimmerman with DomesticFuel.com.
Hi, gentlemen. Talking about the hearing tomorrow, I see from the lineup that both Tom and Bob are going to be testifying, and just wanted to get your both of your feedback on the lineup for witnesses at this particular hearing, because most of them tend to be a little bit one-sided, but this one looks like it's a little bit more well-rounded.
I give the House Energy and Committee a great deal of credit for creating a process that is designed to come to a clearer understanding of the impact of the RFS and not running into this with preconceived notions. So, Cindy, I think you've made a good observation. I think the lineup over the next couple of days is far more balanced than we've seen from, let's say, the House Science Committee that wasn't interested in hearing from the other side. But I think, you know, again, I said it earlier, this committee has created a process that's designed to understand the issues, and it's not a rush to legislate. They may get there eventually if there's consensus, but I don't see that that's where they're necessarily going. The white papers were designed to educate members that may not have been around when the RFS was first passed, and you do need to remember that fully half of the Congress was not in that body in 2005 when the RFS was first passed. So, I mean, I think that's why we took this process so seriously, and why I know tomorrow I'm looking forward to clarifying some of the misinformation that has been out there with respect to the RFS and engaging the members of the committee in a conversation about just why this program has been so successful and the consequence of changing it right now.
Cindy, this is Tom. I agree with what Bob said. The Energy and Commerce Committee, Chairman Upton and Ranking Member both indicated they wanted to get a lot of the facts out on the table, and that's really helpful for our industry, that oftentimes, as you know, we've faced significant challenges with misinformation or sometimes outright lies out there that have been pushed by some of the critics. And it does give us the opportunity to be able to present the facts. And, you know, if Congress is doing their job, they will take this seriously. And I think the Energy and Commerce Committee is doing so.
All right. And it looks like that does conclude our question and answer session at this time. I'll turn the call back over to Ann O'Neill for any final or additional comments.
Great, thank you, and thanks everyone who joined the call today. As always, please feel free to reach out to us if you have further questions. Alyssa Ohl, I'm sure many of you have her contact information. So again, thanks for joining, and we'll speak with you soon.